Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is Charles Max Wood, and this week we're going to be talking with Ryan Smith from Heroku. It was just a terrific chat that we had. We talked about all kinds of stuff, everything from the, from Heroku to the worker pattern to queuing. The way I found him was that he commented on the Ruby Rogues podcast where we Q Classic was mentioned. So we talked about a lot of that stuff. And anyway, it was just a great discussion, and I'm looking forward to listening to this again and giving you some great feedback or some great show notes. If you want the show notes, you can get them at teachmedico.com. You can also get screencasts and some blog posts that I put up there from time to time. So feel free to go check those out. And before we really get into this too far, I need to mention that we are sponsored by New Relic. I've actually been using New Relic RPM for the last couple of weeks to speed up one of my clients' websites. They weren't happy with some of the response times. And so if you're looking for that kind of information, you know, response times and where the time's being spent and how it breaks down, where problems occur, there's just nothing else like it. It does such a great job giving you all the information you need. And you can check them out at newrelic.com. You can also find them by going to the website, teachmetocode.com, and clicking on the link there. If you have any questions, you can email me also at chuck@teachmetocode.com, and I can probably help you in using their software. Now, we'll get into the interview, and I'll catch you on the other end. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is Charles Maxwood, and this week I'm talking to Ryan Smith. Now, Ryan is an engineer over at Heroku. Some of you may have used them for some of your hosting if you're Ruby on Rails or some other rack-based application. He blogs at ryan.smith.heroku.com. You can also find him on Twitter as ryan.smith, and dot is spelled out. It's not just a dot. So it's Ryan D.O.T. Smith. And the way I ran into him was actually he left a comment on the Ruby Rogues podcast because we had the URL incorrect for Q Classic, which is actually a queuing system that runs on Postgres SQL. And so I thought it would be interesting to have him come on, talk about Heroku, talk about Q Classic and Postgres, and just kind of get his opinion on that. He also spoke at RailsConf this year. Did you speak about the worker pattern?
Right. Yeah. At RailsConf, I spoke about the worker pattern. Correct.
All right. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. So first off, you know, we kind of got introduced talking about Q Classic, and James Edward Gray is actually the one that brought it up on the podcast. I'm a little curious, why write another queuing system?
Right. Well, it's a very legitimate question. And the answer to that question is really, you know, I needed a database-backed queue for some projects that I was working on here at Heroku. And these projects actually required a great deal of performance. And I just wasn't able to get the performance out of delay job. It didn't allow for the concurrency that I required for these applications. So you know, I'm a big fan of Postgres. I think it works for. I think it has great features that make it suitable for a queuing system. And so I just kind of set out to build. And embrace the features of Postgres. I set out to build a queuing system that would get me the level of concurrency that I needed, and it would get me the performance that I was looking for. So basically it was just kind of just scratch an itch that I had. And I didn't want to stand up an AMP queue instance, and I didn't even want to stand up a Redis instance. Like I had a Postgres database available to me. I like being able to execute SQL on my queues to do some introspection. You know, I was comfortable with all that, and I didn't need Redis, and I didn't need AMP queue, and so I wrote my library to kind of scratch that itch.
Okay, so I'm a little curious. You're talking about concurrency with the delayed job didn't have that. Right. This had. So, what were you trying to do with it? I guess.
Okay, well, so the use case was I was running about 80 to 100 workers on Heroku. Mm-hmm. And so at any given time, I would have, 100, say workers trying to pick jobs off the queue.
Mm-hmm.
And with delayed job, I saw a great amount of contention on my database, because here were 100 Postgres connections, and they were all like simultaneously executing, or they were selecting from the database, and only one of them could lock the job, and mm-hmm. and then delayed job does kind of like a sleep and select algorithm, as does Redis, I believe, but they kind of try and lock a job, and if they didn't, then they back off the connection, and then they try again, right? And so this mm-hmm. is never round trip, which eats a lot of your performance. It also kind of hammers your database because you have a whole, a lot of connections, issuing selects at the same time, and so I saw some CPU load issue there, and so while I was making these observations, I realized that hey, Postgres has this cool PubSub feature, and that would be a great use case for a queuing library in which a worker tries to get a job, it doesn't. So instead of backing off the connection, I can just like block and wait on that connection. And mm-hmm. when work becomes available, I can notify all of my workers on a channel saying, hey, there's new work. And so then the workers can try their luck again. So I forgot what the original question was, but.
Initially I asked why another queuing system, and then I was asking about the concurrency. So that makes a lot of sense. And, I can see where, you wouldn't want it to make another round trip. Yeah, you just wait until you can get what you need. And, right. and that makes a lot of sense. Is that really the only defining feature of Queue Classic as opposed to delayed job? Or what else is there to it?
Well, so that was kind of like the cornerstone of Queue Classic. That's kind of what made me go down the path of writing another queuing solution. Was I wanted that concurrency. But then along the way, I implemented some other features that I always kind of wanted from delayed job, but they never had. Mm-hmm. One being I didn't really like the interface of writing a class and then having to provide a perform method on that. Basically, like a lot of my code, I had these classes that had these class methods that I would want to, run in the background. Mm-hmm. And so with Queue Classic, the signature is just a combination of a class and a method to call in that class. So that's another feature that I have. I think is a simpler API. Now I don't do any sort of like handle, like async or send later. Like I don't implement a lot of that magic. I think like my API is very simple. You could read, I encourage everybody to read through the code. Like I've tried to make it as simple and as clean as I can. But let's see. Oh, also, I wasn't really happy with the idea of storing my jobs in YAML. Mm-hmm. It made it sometimes difficult for me to parse. I think one of the big advantages of having your queuing system built on top of a relational database is the ability to introspect it, because you can write as many SQL queries as you want to give you all sorts of performance metrics and to give you a good snapshot of, what your queue is, what state your queue is in. And so, having all of my jobs in YAML made it kind of difficult for me to parse. Right now I'm storing all of the job details as a JSON inside of a text column in Postgres. And this allows me to, it gives me greater, a better ability to introspect the queue and to write some SQL statements to let me know what's going on. Also, there's promise of a JSON data type being native in Postgres. And it was a Google Summer of Code project a few years back, and it's worked really well, and it's a contrib module now. But they're talking of putting it into Postgres Core soon, and the day that happens, I will be utilizing that in my queuing library because I would love to have a native JSON data type. Postgres, I don't know if you're aware of this, but they have a wonderful XML native data type. Now, I know a lot of people in the Ruby community kind of shudder when they hear the words XML. But it's there, and it supports XPath querying, which is very powerful. And so I'm sure that when JSON gets worked into Postgres, like it's going to be right, and it's going to work wonderfully. And I should also take the time to mention now that another strong feature of Queue Classic is is my dependencies. You know, one of the reasons why QClassic is so fast is that I don't rely on Active Record or Active Support or anything like that. In fact, I only have two dependencies, and the dependencies are the PGGem and the JSON library. So I write all of my SQL by hand because, you know, that's what gives me my performance, is that, you know, I'm embracing Postgres. I'm embracing the database. Like, I'm using database features here, you know. The Ruby, the library, is just a very thin layer. You know, it's a wrapper around Postgres, really.
Well, that's interesting. That's really interesting. So I guess another question is, and I have to say that the JSON data type really appeals to me, for a couple of reasons. One is that it's a standard notation,
right,
that a lot of people use. It's simpler than XML, and but the other thing is it kind of gives you this how can I say it? It kind of gives you almost this NoSQL option on your SQL.
Right,
because, I mean, effectively you have a hash type in your database.
Which is very interesting, because I know that Aaron Patterson kind of made a big deal of it at RailsConf, but so Postgres has a feature called HStore, and essentially that's kind of like NoSQL in Postgres. It's a wonderful thing to check out, but it essentially allows you to map like a Ruby hash inside of a data type in Postgres, and you can do all sorts of like cool manipulation on an HStore. It's basically a key value store data type for Postgres.
Wow.
And so I've also even kicked around the idea of putting my jobs into an HStore, and you can do all sorts of, you know, really interesting things on it. So you know, you talk about having a NoSQL, you know, kind of column in your database. Well, HStore was implemented to be just that. So definitely, you know, if that idea interests you, HStore should definitely provide some, some good reading anyways. And then, you know,
all right,
all sorts of cool use cases for it.
Interesting. Now I have to ask, and I'm going to confess a little bit of ignorance here, simply because I generally use MySQL, but it's really out of laziness, not out of anything else. Mm-hmm. You know, I got started on MySQL, and that's kind of where I've been for the last, 4 or 5 years. What is it about Postgres that makes it so appealing?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and I'm sure it's going to spark, you know, much religious debate, but, you know. But I'll kind of share, you know, my thoughts on it. For a long time, actually, MySQL was a lot more stable and a lot more, you know, reliable than Postgres. You know, I think, you know, 6 or 7 years ago, you know, MySQL was definitely had a step ahead of Postgres. But since then, you know, Postgres has just been putting out some really solid features. You know, they've really nailed transactions, and they've really nailed locking, for instance. I'm not sure exactly where MySQL stands on this now, but I knew a few years back, MVCC was kind of like a new thing to MySQL. Postgres has always done a really good job of implementing that. Like, are you familiar with MVCC? Have you heard the term?
No.
And so MVCC is multi-version concurrency control. And it's actually one of the fundamental features that I'm using in QClassic, actually. So just a quick example of how it works. So let's say that I have a row and a table, and I have two processes that are going to be working on that same row, right? So there's kind of like a race condition there, you know,
right.
Like one process might select it, and the other one might select it, and they might be doing updates on it, and who, you know, which order do the updates happen in, you know, questions like that. So what MVCC does is it's a locking mechanism that's handled by Postgres. So the operator of the database doesn't necessarily have to know, you know, how it works, other than, like, you know, we can just rely that Postgres will do the right thing. And so what it looks like in Postgres is you can issue a select statement, and you can say in your select statement that it's for an update. And so I actually do this. So when my workers come into Postgres and they want to select a job to lock, you know, to work on, what I do is I select a row, and I say that it's for update. And so that means that the next thread that comes in and tries to lock that job, they will be blocked on it, because I already have my process has a lock on that row. So I have to be done with that lock before this other thread can access and manipulate the data. And so, you know, that's a very fundamental feature that that Postgres has been good on for a while. And to be honest, I haven't followed MySQL in recent years. They might have gotten to that level with their locking, but I know that they weren't there a few years ago. In fact, I think the locking actually involved putting a lock on the table, which you know kind of really hammers your performance.
Just a little.
Yeah.
All right. That makes sense. It sounds like there are a lot of features. You know, every time I talk to somebody about this, you know, they have some other thing, you know, and I think it depends on how they're using it that they bring up that they're like, yeah, you know, Postgres just does this a lot better. And yeah, I don't keep up really on, you know, what changes are coming through on the database engines. But, you know, the more I hear about Postgres, the more I'm really thinking I should give it a hard look and just see what's there. The other thing that really bothers me about MySQL, and it has nothing to do with the database engine, and that really just comes down to the fact that it's owned by Oracle, you know, which is owned by Sun, which doesn't make it any better, you know. Right. But you know, and my history with both of their core technologies has just been kind of sorted at best. So, you know, I really wonder when Sun picked them up and then when Oracle bought Sun, you know, just where it's going to go, especially since Oracle really has every incentive to drive people to use their primary database engine, which is an enterprise product that costs a lot of money.
Absolutely.
So anyway.
So to contrast that, Postgres has a very interesting history, and its history is for the most part academic. You know, the name kind of hints that it's, you know, like post something else, uh-huh. Right? And so kind of Ingress was, you know, the first kind of implementation of that database. And then a bunch of academics at Berkeley, I believe, set out to like fix a lot of these, you know, these database problems that they were having with Ingress. Mm-hmm. And so Postgres started out like in an academic lab. And then it kind of got pushed into open source community. And then, you know, and then it's kind of flourished from there. But Postgres has a, you know, it's very much a community project, and it's very much, you know, it came from the academic lab. Like it's got a really good feel to the community, and there's a lot of academic interest in Postgres. In fact, if you browse the to-do wiki for Postgres, you'll see a lot of cool new indexing technology on there. Mm-hmm. And most of the and all the links to the indexing technology point to like academic research papers, and there's great reading to be had there. It's a very cool project, and it doesn't feel corporate at all. So that's another reason why I enjoy using Postgres, because of that community. You know, that's, you know, I found Ruby because of the wonderful community, and so you know, topics like that, while they don't, you know, while they don't say much about the technology or the components of the technology, you know, the community does matter, I believe, and that's a nice thing that Postgres has going for it.
That really does appeal to me in a lot of ways, and you know, for a lot of the same reasons, I was getting into Ruby. You know, what kept me here really was the community. Mm-hmm. You know, and I kind of got into it for Rails, and after a while, after playing with Rails, you know, I really kind of found Ruby, even though I'd been programming in it for a while. And mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just, you know, I've stayed for the Ruby and for the Ruby community.
Nice.
And you know, I think a lot of that could be said probably for a lot of the people who are supporting Postgres. Now I want to change tactics a little bit for you.
Okay.
I'm a little curious about Heroku. I remember when Heroku first came around, I tried it out. It was this really, how do I want to say this diplomatically?
It's okay. Was it the garden? Are you talking about the garden?
It was this really awful way to write code online.
Yeah, Heroku garden.
It was, I mean, you know, I remember thinking, well, this would be handy in a pinch if my arm got cut off and my teeth got pulled out and I had no choice but to, you know, type it with my nose. You know, I mean, really, it was awful.
And I thought the same thing when I first noticed it. But then I had this aha moment when, after I got done like breaking my fingers writing code in this online IDE, and then I realized, oh my gosh, it also hosts your application for you.
Yeah, and the hosting is the real magic, I think. I really moved away from Heroku for a long time, you know, and people kept saying, dude, you got to try Heroku. And I'm like, no, I've been there. And so I was trying it a while ago, and it was this really handy, just really nice interface where it's like, create your app, don't really think about it, and then do a git push to it. And it's like, oh, this is really refreshing.
Yeah, you use Git, right?
Yeah.
So then you pretty much know how to use Heroku.
Yeah. So I'm a little curious about a couple of things. One is what kind of company is it to work for?
Oh, man. I absolutely love working for Heroku. It's very much, a hacker's kind of fantasy almost. Like the company is, the majority of the people in the company are engineers. The company was founded by engineers. And so that kind of background really speaks a lot about the culture. Our company, we embrace the Unix philosophy very much. Mm-hmm. And that kind of shines through our product, but it also kind of shines through in our team structure. For instance, Unix is known for having many small, well-defined, sharp tools. Commands like yes and cat. They're very small and they do one thing and they do that one thing very well. Well, at Heroku, our team structure is very much like that. We're broken down into very small, discrete teams, and we have a very focused mission. And I absolutely love working in that sort of environment. We also are very open-minded to the tools and to the methods that we use, and so we're always encouraged to take a different approach to a problem, whether that means not using Ruby, using another tool, the tool that's best for the job. That philosophy is definitely here as well. There's so many smart people that work on our team. I'm always challenged and sharpened. I definitely feel like I'm the small fish in the big pond, and so it's a good feeling to have.
Yeah, definitely. I had a lot of that feeling when I was working for Mosey. Mm-hmm. And I got in when there were like 10 people in the company, and over the last few years they've actually been purchased by a big corporate. And that's something else I'm going to ask you about, of course. But they got bought out by a big corporate giant, and the whole company feel changed, and just things like that. It was really interesting. But yeah, I mean, initially when we were first getting started, it was almost a group of believers, where it was like, our mission is to save people's data, because they did online backup. They still do, I guess. Yeah, they're not as good at it as they were, in my opinion. But anyway, it was a really great place to be because it felt like we were making a difference. We're adding to the community. We're putting stuff out there that people can use. And I'd been a sysadmin before that. So, I mean, backup was a big deal to me then. And, it made sense for people's personal data. So I'm a little curious about the changes to your... Oh, I got a text or something. Anyway, I'm a little curious about your experience with getting acquired, because you got picked up by Salesforce, didn't you guys?
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So they have their fingers in the pie yet?
No. And before the acquisition went down, let me back up by saying, like, my view of Salesforce has changed radically since the acquisition happened. Before the acquisition, I thought, because I had actually, and even before I worked at Heroku, I had done some consulting and had written some applications that integrated with Salesforce.
I'm so sorry.
It was gnarly, man. SOAP APIs, Apex. What the heck is Apex? So anyways, that was kind of like my view of Salesforce. And then the more that I've learned about their company, the more I've been impressed. The people who founded Salesforce was three guys, mm-hmm. and those three guys are still at the company. And Mark Benioff, the CEO, he's like one of the founders and he's the chairman. Like, he's still there, like calling the shots. Like, they didn't sell out. They're still trying to build something awesome. I think that really kind of resonated with me. The fact that they're all still there, they're all still committed. They don't have to be there. They're right. They're making the money, but they're still there and they're still trying to innovate. And so that boded very well with me. And so during the acquisition, they made it very clear. In fact, the CEO even told us that they were not going to. They liked what we were doing. Like, they wanted us to be better at it. They acknowledged that we were doing well in the space. Uh-huh. And so they took a very hands-off approach, and they gave us a lot of trust and said, you guys are doing awesome. Keep doing it. you know, we just want to be there to support you. You know, we're going to be the wind beneath your wings or whatever, right?
Right.
Like, and they're still true to that. And to be honest, like, they've been building web apps and hosting web apps since like the 90s, right? Like they're not new to this game of you know building you know SaaS and having you know data centers that host web applications. Like, you know, this is something that they're very good at and they've been doing for a while. So we even hope to learn some stuff from them.
Right. So I'm a little curious about their angle. I mean, what are they hoping to get from Heroku? Are they looking to take advantage of the technology that you've set up, or are they just, you know, looking for another revenue center? Or
so you know, I must say that, you know, you can't, like, I am an engineer and I didn't negotiate the,
right,
the acquisition or whatever. But here my thought on it is kind of that. So I mentioned Apex before, right? So Apex is like this language, this framework that they made to let developers kind of build onto their platform. Like, they can write business applications using this framework.
Right.
And this is awful. Like, for instance, I had to attend a meeting where they were talking about the Apex, mm-hmm. and a bunch of Apex developers were there asking for features. The number one feature that they asked for was files to put their source code in. They didn't have directories. Oh, I'm sorry, I said files, folders. They didn't have Apex doesn't have you can't put your code in directories. It's all in one.
Oh, man.
I mean, this technology is rugged, man. It's like it's really rugged. And so So it's clear that they needed something else, right? People weren't happy developing Apex or whatever. And so they saw Ruby, they saw Rails, were like, oh, this is perfect. You know, developers love it. Like, people are so happy developing, you know, Rails applications and building these kind of, you know, business integration apps. Uh-huh. And so then they thought, well, we need to host Ruby on Rails, you know? And, well, it turns out that we were already doing that. We were doing it really, really well. And so I think it kind of made sense for them to take us on and make us their own.
Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. And I can definitely see where, if they're going to allow people to extend in that direction, you know, where they can use some kind of framework that's based in Ruby, and then, you know, essentially, yeah, allow people to just host their stuff, you know, just put it over there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but we're keeping our brand. I still have my business card. You know, you can still email me, ryan@heroku.com. Like, that's not changing. Like, we're in our own office.
Right.
We're still main, because our brand is, I think it's really good. Like, it even before I worked here, like, the Heroku brand always appealed to me. I thought they had good taste and good design, and it was a good feel. So we're definitely keeping that.
Yeah, I have a t-shirt from Heroku that I, hang on. Where's my phone? Sorry. Hello. I'm doing a podcast interview. No, I'll talk to you in a minute. Bye. Note to self, cut that out. Yeah, that was my wife. Did you get my text message? No, I'm doing a podcast interview. Oh, sorry.
Nice.
All right. Well, I was going to change tactics anyway. So here we go. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the worker pattern? I looked at your blog. There was a little diagram there. I kind of crossed my eyes at it because there were a bunch of arrows on it. And that's about as far as I got.
Yeah. Just above the diagram with all the arrows, I think there's a link to a slide deck, which is a much more prettier representation of that material. I'd encourage you to check that out. It might be easier on the eyes.
Oh, I didn't even see that slide deck. All right.
Right. So there's some more material there. But basically, one of the things that I've noticed, you know, in my career as a web applications engineer is that, and I think this will resonate well with the Rails community as well, because there's always a push, you know, like bat models, some controllers, right? Well, I think the reason why we say that is because we're typically doing too many things inside of a web request.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this is true across all web frameworks. I've spent the majority of my time building web applications in Rails, but it seems so tempting to do other things inside of a web request.
What do you mean?
Well, okay, so I think a web request is merely a client asking for something and the server responding, you know, to that request as quickly as it can.
Right.
And so sometimes, like, we want our web servers to always respond with the data. When sometimes if they don't have the data, you know, like we may want to work to get that data and then send it back. And we do all this on the user's time, right?
Right.
So what the worker pattern kind of establishes is that, like, if a client asks for data from a web server, it's okay for the web server to say, you know what, I don't have that data right now. And, you know, and then, you know, check back later or use a different transport to get the data to the client.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, so the idea is that we make our web requests very thick and make them, you know, very small, and we do very little inside of them. And any sort of processing for this request, whether it's a SQL query, whether it's a huge database write, whether it's remote APIs, like, all of those things do not belong to the user request. You know, that's basically, you know, I want to be very cautious and mindful of a user request because that's the user's time. Like, we're messing around on their time now. So any sort of, you know, any sort of back-end work that we as developers need to do needs to be out of band. It needs to be off the user's time. It needs to be on our own time, and we can push that data, you know, back when we have it. You know, it's about building a very snappy user experience. It's,
uh-huh.
Yeah. So the worker pattern is kind of just you know, a thought, an exploration into those topics.
So basically, what you're saying is it should either say, I've got it for you, it's ready, here it is. Or it should say, I don't have it right now, but I can find it, and I'll get it to you when it's available. And then it can... And when you say another transport, are you talking about an email, or are you talking about, you know, coming back with another response, or, you know, where it double checks, or what?
So there's all sorts of great things to do in that area, right? So on my blog post and in my RailsConf talk, I highlighted one technique for a transport, and that is polling, right? So the client mm-hmm. will just, you know, and I think I used JavaScript, right? So the client would just say, hey, do you have the data yet? And the web server would say, no, I don't, but, you know, I'm working on it. And then, you know, the client would pull, and eventually the web server would say, okay, I finally got the data, here it is, right?
Right.
So JavaScript polling is one technique. However, that's not the only technique. There's comment, right? There's all sorts of solutions there. And there's even WebSockets now.
Mm-hmm.
So there's several different techniques that you can take to push the data back to your client. But the point is that, like, it's not all inside of one large HTTP request.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what I mean by other transports, I guess.
Interesting. So it looked like in your little diagram that you had several different layers there.
Mm-hmm.
So you had the web server, Memcached, and then remote API, which I guess could actually be your browser or whatever. So are you basically, you know, at what stage do you say, I don't have it ready? I mean, if it's not in cache, are you not ready? Or if you can, you know, build the response quickly enough, then is it okay to return it from the web server?
Well, so generally my rule has always been, if you have to go to a remote API, if you have to make never make an HTTP request inside of an HTTP request.
Right, right.
You know, like, I think that's a good tip off that you need to apply the worker pattern. You know, so in the case where I am diagramming, you know, like the web server, the worker, and Memcache,
mm-hmm.
What I'm doing is, you know, when the web server receives a request from the client for data, the first thing I do is I check my Memcache and I say, do I have the data to respond to this request?
Right.
In the case that it's not in Memcache, then I just enqueue a message, you know, to a worker saying, hey, go get this data. When you've gotten the data, write it to Memcache because I'm going to be checking back there soon, right? So
uh-huh.
then, you know, the web server dispatches the worker. The worker has its, you know, it can try and go get the data or whatever, right? Meanwhile, we've already responded to the client saying, hey, we don't have it yet, but check back later, right? So then, you know, a few clicks later, the client comes back online and says, hey, do you have that data yet? And finally, our web server can say, you know, yes, the worker wrote it into Memcache, so I'm going to get the data out of Memcache for you. I'm just going to ship it right back to the client, right? So in that case there, the web server didn't have to do any heavy lifting. All it had to do was read from Memcache, you know? So it was, you know, very snappy. We've distributed our components, you know? So this way, you know, maybe the worker is just a copy of our Rails application, you know, maybe it's the same application, but maybe it could have been some other application, right? Like the worker could have been just a plain old Ruby class that knew how to get data from a weather API or something, right?
Right.
And so there's all sorts of advantages of both performance and breaking out your components into different, you know, into different applications so that, you know, different teams can work on them. The benefits are really limitless. There's so much value to be had there.
Right. And one other thing that strikes me is that it doesn't have to be like the whole page. I can see people envisioning that, you know, you make the request and it comes back and, you know, it basically gives you this big loading thing in your browser, where in reality it could give you back the layout, it could give you back, you know, the components it has the data for, and then give you the loading, you know, in the couple of places where it's still waiting for it to aggregate whatever it needs.
Absolutely.
And I think that's actually a lot more useful than you know, the other methodologies where, you know, at least you're getting something back that you can work with. And then as the data comes in, or if they get what they need and they can move on, then, you know, in the case of JavaScript, your AJAX request just quit coming. And so, you know, it's not trying to reload the data anymore. So, you know, it's there next time they need it. But, you know, we're in good shape now. That makes sense.
Yep.
I like it. Now, who came up with the worker pattern?
You know, I don't know. And I think if you Google for the worker pattern, there's not a lot of it's not a Gang of Four thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of like implicit among web application developers. I think they know what it is innately.
Right.
But I don't know the answer to that question. I in my slides, I kind of made up my own definition.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of it off the top of my head, but it's definitely in my slides on the worker pattern article on my website. It says something to the effect of, you know, the worker pattern explicitly decouples the services required to respond to a web request or something like that. Like, it pretty much enforces that, like, you know, it divides your architecture into responding to web requests and getting the data needed for that web request.
Right. I just looked it up. It says the worker pattern explicitly decouples the web request from the services required to respond to the request.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's kind of the definition that I made up, and it felt pretty good to me.
Yeah, it also makes a lot of sense in an area where, and this is something that I've had experience with, where we built this monolithic Rails app, and then what wound up happening was everything was so tightly coupled that you couldn't move something over here without something over here getting broken.
Right.
And so eventually what we wound up doing was we actually re-architected it, broke things out into services, and then, you know, worked that out. And there was a lot of queuing and, you know, HTTPing back and forth and, you know, to get the data and, you know, put it all together and, you know, do whatever it needed to do. But, you know, something like this where, yeah, you know, you effectively give them what you have and then say, we're getting the rest. You know, even though it may be a service that's on the same machine, you know, there's like zero latency for it to actually make the request. But it's still something that may take a minute to, you know, to gather all the data and put it into a sane form. It really does, you know, appeal in a lot of ways where, you know, it's not just external APIs, but maybe within your own application to gather the information.
Absolutely. Yep.
All right. Well, I don't know if I have any other questions for you. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about before we wrap this up?
I don't think so. I think we covered it pretty well. I think this is a good time to plug Q Classic, and I just want to reiterate on the fact that, you know, there's many solutions out there for queuing, and, you know, there will never be one of them that will be good for all situations.
Right.
There are reasons why you would want to use a database backed queue, mm-hmm. And there are reasons why you'd want to use, you know, AMQ or RabbitMQ or Beanstalk. And so some of the reasons why I think you'd want to use a database backed queue are, you know, maybe you don't want to add a new piece to your infrastructure. Maybe you already have Postgres running. And often I find that, like, if your worker is your Rails app, right? Like, if all of your worker code is inside your Rails application, then it seems that, you know, using a database backed queue is a lot easier than, you know, introducing, you know, RabbitMQ or Beanstalk, you know, adding that extra, you know, service to your architecture.
Right.
And the durability that Postgres gives you, you know, like, you're not going to lose, like, if your server crashes, you're still going to have all the jobs in your queue. That's guaranteed.
Right.
So, you know, there's a whole bunch, you know, there's many different reasons why you'd want to use different solutions. But I think that if a database backed queue, you know, fits your bill and you're running Postgres, you know, Q Classic is the way to go. Like, I'm embracing Postgres. There's very little reason why you would not want to use it.
Sounds good. Well, I'll have to check it out. Maybe I'll do a screencast on it.
Right on. Yeah. Well, yeah. Feel free to you know, give me feedback, and you know, anywhere I can help improve the code, I'm always eager to do that.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on to the podcast. For those who are listening, you can find Ryan on Twitter at ryan.smith. That's Ryan, D-O-T, Smith. You can also find him at ryan.smith.heroku.com. That's where he blogs. Looks like he's blogged about once a month for the last 2 months or something. But anyway, you know, there's a lot there. You can also, you know, look at a slide deck. And that was something that, you know, once I browse through it, it really clarifies some of the things with the worker pattern. So, you know, I recommend you go check that out. It's the top link on his blog, so you can just find it there. And, you know, thanks again for coming onto the podcast. I really, really appreciate, you know, both people who contribute to the community and people who are willing to come on podcasts like this and talk about it and kind of explain, you know, why I should care, because there are so many technologies out there. And it's really hard to just nail down, this is important, this is relevant to me, this one isn't, you know. And so if we can get some of these details, then we can really start to figure out, oh, I really do need something like Q Classic.
Sure. Yeah, and my door is always open. If you ever have a question about whether you should use the library, email me, ryan@heroku.com, and I'll be glad to help you decide if it's the right choice for you.
All right. Well, enjoy your time under your new corporate overlords, and we will catch you later.
Right on. Thanks a lot. Bye. Yeah,
thank you. Bye. And we're back. I just want to thank Ryan one more time for coming onto the podcast. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the time that he set aside for this. He was really fun to talk to, and like I said, you know, had some cool insights on some of the open source software that he works on and on Heroku. So I wish him and Heroku all the best, and just want to thank him for that. If you want to get a hold of me, you can. You can find me at chuck@teachmetocode.com. You can find all of the stuff that I do at teachmetocode.com, railscoach.com, rubyrogues.com, and intentionalexcellencepodcast.com. I'm on Twitter at cmaxw. I'm on GitHub as Charles Max Wood, and you can call me also at 801-367-6164. I had a few people point out that the Hire Me page was not working. I've gotten that fixed. I still need to update the About page, and there are a few other things that I want to update. So I'll keep you posted on that. But by all means, if you have a problem with the website or you see something that I need to fix, let me know. I also appreciate your feedback. And if you have a topic for the podcast or someone you'd like to see interviewed, then by all means, go to teachmetocode.com, click Request a Topic, vote up the ones that you like, or put your own suggestion in, and I'll be happy to consider those and take over on putting out a screencast or a podcast related to those. If you have any other questions, that's a great way to get a hold of me. And finally, hopefully this weekend I'll be able to get teachmetocodeacademy.com up and running so that you those of you who are looking for my Ruby on Rails course can sign up for it and get running with that. And otherwise, if you have any questions, just give me an email, chuck@teachmetocode.com. Thank you very much.